Okay, let's get started. Even though we're a couple minutes early, we're going to let some people filter in because I yacked a little too much in the morning session. I'll try to stay more to task for this. But just to kind of bring us back to speed, for those of you who were here when we first started Bill's story, we're seeing how these miracles, these absolute miracles occurred, and how the universe was coming together to bring us this unbelievable program. And that when we were here and we broke for lunch, we were talking about how God, through Ebby, came into Bill's life. And at first he was resisting it. At first he was extremely recalcitrant to this idea of a power of the universe and a God universal. We were on page 11, and we're on the paragraph, The Wars. And before we read this paragraph, let's just remember that probably there's not a person in this room, probably there's not a person that I know that has not asked these very same questions and raised these very same issues about God. And what I had to do was I had to, again, as I talked about this morning, I had to develop a concept of God that worked for me. And each and every one of us is called upon to do that very same thing. Let's see how Bill Wilson gets to that conclusion of a God that is personal to him. And let's see how that process takes place and see if it doesn't, as I said this morning, become more our story and less the story, and less the story of some person who lived a long time ago. So let's pick it up on page 11, second paragraph, right, George? Second paragraph, the wars, thank you, which had been fought, the burnings, the chicanery, that religious dispute had facilitated made me sick. I honestly doubted whether on balance the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible. The brotherhood of man, a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. This is a very important paragraph for me to remember. The next couple of paragraphs are going to open the door for me to be a part of this organization and for me to be able to hold God's hand and for him to direct me in my life. Because if I had to utilize the God of my childhood, if I had to go back to the God of my religion, as wonderful as that is, it would not have kept me out of the food for 4 seconds. It would not have done it. Let's see where he goes from here, and let's see how Bill redefined his definition of miracles when it says, "But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known." Now, if that isn't enough to convince me, I don't know what is, because that's a heck of a powerful paragraph. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. Had there been no more power in him than there was in me at that moment and minute, and that was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table, and he shouted, "Great tidings." And what that says to me in that paragraph is that I have to stop looking for a burning bush. I have to stop looking for the splitting of the Red Sea. Those are very nice, and they're wonderful, and Hollywood can recreate them very realistically in movies and shows and everything else. What I had to say to myself after reading that and absorbing it is, I'm looking right now at a room full of compulsive overeaters, including myself, and again, as I said, I do not know what you did this morning. I don't know what you're thinking about right now. I don't know where you're going to go after this meeting is over. But what I see, and what you could see if you came up here to stand with me, is I'm looking at a room full of compulsive overeaters who are not currently compulsively overeating. And if that isn't enough of a miracle for me, then I am beyond hope. I have to look at this room. I don't have to look at Ebby. He's dead. I look at this room and I see people who were born with an obsession of the mind, who were born with a physical allergy, and they are not currently compulsively overeating. I'm looking at smiling faces. Some of you are even awake. And I'm looking at smiling faces. That is a miracle. And here we are. We're in this 50th birthday of Overeaters Anonymous, and we're in this beautiful hotel, and we're having our celebration. What a miracle. What a miracle. So it's really up to me to say to myself, is that enough? You bet it is. You bet it is. Okay, I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. Now, in the next sentence, Ebby Thatcher, based on what he had learned in the Oxford Group movement, a group of people not at all concerned with the treatment of alcoholism, that were people that were practicing first century Christianity, and Ebby Thatcher is about to say something to Bill Wilson that is going to spring open the door for countless millions of compulsive overeaters, addicts, alcoholics, what have you. And Ebby Thatcher is going to bring into this world the welcome mat that I need to come in here and recover. And he is going to say to Bill, my friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? I've never had any problem with my conception of anything. And as long as I can conceive of what God is and what God isn't, and as long as I can define what that God is, and as long as I can be open to the fact of yes, there is, rather than no, there's not, I can recover. What is the spiritual part of this program? It's like asking me, what's the wet part of Lake Michigan? This is a spiritual program. We don't have to worry about people running out when they hear the word God. The food will beat them right back in. Food is the great persuader. I only have God to go to when I'm that desperate and I've tried every wrong answer that there is. God remains the right answer that's out there. And that's what I need to know. What do they say? There's no atheists in a foxhole. I was in a foxhole. If I stop doing the work, I will be in another foxhole. And this time it'll be much more serious. That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. Look at your capitalizations if you're following along in the book. Your capital hymns, your capital powers, those are references to God. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. People say all the time, well, how could you turn your will and your life over to something that you can't see? Look around you. Look around you at the people not compulsively overeating. Look at the meetings. Look at the miracles. They're all around you. Okay. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans. Oh, sorry, I did that already. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have Him with me, and He came. But soon, the sense of His presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. And so it had been ever since, how blind I had been. At first, at the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. This is Bill Wilson going into the town's hospital in New York. He is under the care of William Duncan Silkworth for the third time. When we started Bill's story this morning, we said Bill is going to be hospitalized for his alcoholism three times. This is the third time that he will be hospitalized for his alcoholism. And let's see where he goes from here. Because the bottom line is, he has been to Oxford Group meetings. He has taken some action around the Oxford Group, but he has not been separated from the alcohol for the last time until he goes into the hospital for the third time. Let's see how God comes into Bill Wilson's life at that hospital. And we're going to see Bill Wilson working the steps if we just look at this, and we're going to look at it in a way that is going to be very personal to us. There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood Him. He is now taking the first couple of steps, and if you look at that language, you'll see it in the third step prayer. Okay? To do with me as He would, I placed myself unreservedly under His care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without Him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sin. So we've seen Bill taking the first three steps with that passage. Now, one of the Oxford Group tenets is ruthlessly face your sins. We see him ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend is capitalized, this is God, take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since. When he ruthlessly faced his sins, what he was doing is what we know today as a four-step inventory. And he was willing to let God remove his defects of character. We haven't seen him take five yet, but he's taken 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7. Now, my schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. Step 5. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. Steps 8. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. 9. He's actually got to go out and do 9, but you see he's willing to take 9. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. So now we have seen Bill taking all of the first 9 steps in the town's hospital with Ebby. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus just become uncommon sense, and we're seeing him take step 11 there, sought through prayer and meditation. Okay? I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Watch your capitals. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. Then that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. He has now taken the first 11 steps in the town's hospital. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Bill always maintained through his life in writings and in speaking that he had the white light come to him of God in the town's hospital, that he felt the presence of God as he lay in that hospital. For a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head saying, "Something has happened to you I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." The good doctor now sees many men who've had such experiences. He knows they are real. Now, before I read the next little line here, what I want to remind you of is that Bill Wilson is like me in that he is a selfish, self-centered, self-seeking individual who was looking to take from the world that he was born into and not give to it. He was a typical addict. He lied when the truth would have served him better. He did a lot of things of which he was greatly ashamed of. And what happens to him now that he is thinking and doing things differently than he has ever thought them and done them before? What happens is, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. He's now taking step 12. He is looking to turn what he has been given. And remember, we talked about with Roland and with Ebby, we talked about give testimony. Well, he's going to take that principle and make that into our step 12. And he is now resolutely thinking of others. Okay? My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all of my affairs. That's the part of step 12, last part. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Bill Wilson, no matter how evolved his recovery got, no matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of human being. And as a human being, I'm going to be angry. I'm going to be scared. I'm going to be selfish, self-seeking, and dishonest. That's my default mode. That's who I was born that person, and if I'm not acted upon by God through these actions, I will die in the food. And what Bill is telling me here, perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, that means I have to do 10, 11, and 12 every single day. I'm either moving toward God or I am moving toward the food in all the things I do, and there's no other direction. I have to enlarge and perfect. And invariably, when I see people go out, they stop doing the work. If I stop doing the work, what's the lesson there? They're my teachers. What's the lesson there for me? I stop doing the work, I'm going to hear the graduation song. And the graduation song is, "Welcome to McDonald's, can I take your order, please?" They play that at every graduation. My wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet again. It is designed for living that works in rough going. Now here's another little sideline, and this is how I get in trouble with Jen, but I'm going to risk it here. Lois Wilson changed the direction of the world that we live in today. Bill Wilson was full of enthusiasm when he got out of the hospital. Bill Wilson wanted to sober up drunks. The Oxford group wanted him to go and recruit stockbrokers and Wall Street people to come into the Oxford movement, and they said to him, Bill, you're not being of maximum service. There's a line in the big book where they talk about maximum service. This is an Oxford group expression, okay? And Bill had this idea that he was going to sober up the world. Well, what he didn't do was he didn't share our program. Remember it says in the beginning of the book, we're more than 100 men and women who share? He was telling them. And he went to see a lot of drunks in the bars, and he's dragging them off of bar stools and taking them to the Oxford group meetings. Most of them didn't want to go. And one day he came home, and he says to Lois, I had this vision that I was going to help drunks, Lois. And I am not sobering up anybody. This doesn't work. I'm going to stop doing it. Lois Wilson changed the direction of the world. Remember, miracles are sometimes subtle. And this was God coming into our lives and into my life to save it. Lois Wilson said something to him that she had been asked about many times in the years subsequent. She said to him, but you're staying sober. And it hit him right there. That when all else failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. That he was staying sober. Later on, he would go see Silkworth, and Silkworth would tell him, don't preach to people. Tell them about the hopelessness of your condition. And the next thing he did was he went to see Dr. Bob in Akron with this new strategy, and we know that it worked. But let's see where he goes from here. We commenced to make many fast friends. We talked about how Bill had a lot of fast friends. We talked about how he lost them and became a lone wolf. Now he's working the program. We commenced to make many fast friends. Not fair weather, but fast. And a fellowship has grown up among us, which is a wonderful thing to feel apart. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty. I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in the path that really goes somewhere. All of my life I wanted to go somewhere. All my life it seemed I was going nowhere. It always seemed as if I was waiting for someone else to come along and do something for me to point me in some direction, because I also suffer from the tyranny of helplessness. And that tyranny of helplessness plagues me too, where I want to turn my life and my will over to you because I perceive you as strong and me weak, and maybe you'll raise me and take care of me. And that's not healthy either. So now that I have this program, my life goes somewhere rather than nowhere. George, where am I? Have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted, feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us. In one western city, that be Akron, and its environs, there are 1,000 of us and our families. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuously comic and tragic. Variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seemingly worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it right here, right with us here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. Now, I hope that what we've done by going through this and tying it into food and dieting and willpower is to make it more of a personal thing that we can relate to, that I certainly can relate to. So I hope that in the future it will be less and less the story of some guy who lived a long time ago and more your story, because that's what really makes it come alive for me anyway. Very, very important story. We see a lot of things in here that are vitally important. Okay. Now, I know that in the program that you have, it says we're going to go into the next chapter. I'm going to risk making John mad at me, and we're going to go to page 58, please. Now, in the first the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters of this book, we are actually coming to the conclusions for steps 1 and 2. And it is vital that I be convinced at this point that I am a compulsive overeater, or I won't go on with the steps, I won't go on with the work. And I believe, and I stated this earlier, I believe that God wrote the book. I believe he used Bill's hand to put the ink on the pen, but I believe that God wrote the book. Because as Bill recalls in much of his writings and speakings, that he felt that when he wrote this chapter, the pen just seemed to fly across the page, that it was just taking on a life of its own. And in just a very short period of time, he wrote one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature in this book that the world has ever seen, that has ever known. What is important about this book for me to remember is this, that in the 6,000-7,000 year history of writings and musings about addiction, alcoholism, gluttony, what have you, this book and the prescribed plan of action described in it in detail has saved more lives and been more successful than all other methods combined. That there is an unshakable faith that I have that no matter where I have been, if I work the steps, I will recover. I have an unshakable faith because for the last 11 years, the miracle of my life is not that I have not compulsively overeaten. If you threw me in jail, I wouldn't compulsively overeat. Food is not my problem. And when I sat in rooms and thought, well, food's my problem, I can dispel that in 1 minute. If food was my problem, then hospitals would turn out recovered people because they separate me from the food. If food was my problem, jails, treatment centers, operations, diets, whatever, would turn out winners. And they don't. What is my problem? My problem is me as I manifest in my ego to selfishness, self-seeking, dishonesty, fear, and anger. Did I cover them all? Yeah. That's my problem. And those defects of character will trigger my mental obsession. They'll make me restless, irritable, and discontented unless I can feel at once, when I can feel at once the sense of ease and comfort that comes over me when I'm eating. And when I'm eating for about 31 seconds, the world is a nice place. And on second 32, I feel that guilt and that horror and that hopelessness and that horrible feeling that I get when I've eaten. How in the world did I do this again? And all I want to do at that moment is stop eating. And all I continue doing at that moment is eating even more because I've now triggered the physical allergy. What do I do? Well, my willpower hasn't worked. What do I do? Diets don't work. What do? Psychologists don't work or psychiatrists don't work. They may be fantastic for other things. I'm not knocking psychiatry or psychology or medicine or religion. They're wonderful things. Wonderful things. We're even told in the big book of AA not to discount those things, and we're going to read that later on. But in terms of a defense against the food, they won't work for me. Because I'm different from the norm. I'm a compulsive overeater. What do I do? Well, here's the specific and precise instructions. How it works, chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. The next line is what I call step zero. If you decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. A very important line, that's step zero. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. I never let go of anything that didn't have teeth and claw marks all over it. I never let go of anything I didn't have to. My theory is burn the village. Burn the village. No survivors. Everything gets held on to. And what I'm told here is I must let go absolutely. I have to remember that it's sort of like a vending machine, if you will. If I put in 99 cents and the product is a dollar, what do I get out of the machine? Nothing. I either put it in or I don't. I'm either in recovery or I'm not. I'm either doing the deal or I'm not. Half measures do not give me half a recovery. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Instead of reading the steps, if we can, please let's go to page 263, if you have a fourth edition. 263, if you have a fourth edition. If you have a third edition, it's in there. I don't remember this. I used to know. I don't remember. Let's find out where our 12 steps come from. And let's not forget that this 12-step program came about with a lot of controversy because there was a 6-step program that they were working, and then all of a sudden they had a 12. Just imagine if we came here to the OA birthday and we went back into our groups when this celebration was over and said it's now a 24-step program. You think there'd be some arguing going on? I do too. Let's find out what they were doing before this and how it translates into what we see today. Page 263, fourth edition. Number one, complete deflation. You can see that these guys needed to be deflated. In other words, they needed to be out of ideas, and you've heard me say that a bunch of times. They needed to know that they had to rely on God because they were licked. Two, dependence and guidance from a higher power. Three, moral inventory, and we can all see that. Confession, five, restitution. Well, Bill knew that no good alcoholic was going to go around making restitution, so he made that into two separate steps, 8 and 9. And a little later on, we'll discuss in length 8 and 9. 6, continued work with other alcoholics. He took those 6 and made it into our 12. We can go back to 58 now, 59. Okay? Actually, let's go to page 60. Let's go to page 60. Many of us exclaimed, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. Excuse me. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after made clear 3 pertinent ideas. Before I read these 3 pertinent ideas, I want to make something very clear. We hear these at meetings. They go in one ear. We go out the other ear. We sit down at meetings. They're reading this stuff. And if you're anything like me, you stop paying attention to it because anything I hear that often just doesn't get through. It's just sort of like something we say, like, good morning, how are you, or whatever it is. These are very, very important because unless I have taken the ABCs to heart and I've made those conclusions of the mind, I am not ready to move forward in my program of recovery. It says here that no alcoholic could manage, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own life. And there's people coming in, including me, that don't even know what a compulsive overeater is. But if I haven't read the first four chapters and I haven't absorbed and understood the information in the doctor's opinion, I'm not going to know what a compulsive overeater is. I'm just thinking, well, I'm fat and I need a diet. And we couldn't manage our own lives. There's people sitting in this room, and I said this before, they're managing their lives just fine. In terms of business, maybe. In terms of certain things, maybe. But they cannot, by themselves, of themselves, stay out of the food. Because they have a mental obsession which triggers, and then the allergy which triggers the craving. The mental obsession gets you to the food. The craving, the physical allergy makes it impossible for you to stop once you've started. I can't manage my own life. And that's a conclusion I have to come to based on that knowledge. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. I have to be convinced that money won't do it. Fame won't do it. Fortune won't do it. Sex won't do it. I'd like to try. But sex won't do it. And lack of money won't do it. And read the papers of the people who have seemingly enviable exteriors of their life. Read the obituary columns of the celebrity people. You guys are in the Mecca for that. It's endless. People whose lives you would give anything you could to be living. They are the envy of anyone and everyone in their environment. And they can't stop eating, drugging, drinking, what have you. Many are dead. Did their money save them? Did their fame save them? No. It says that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. I have to try every wrong answer on the block before the right one of God will come to me. That God could and would if He were sought. I have to believe that God will. How do I come to the conclusion God will? Trying everything else. Trying everything else. Being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do? The third step is probably the second most misunderstood step there is. I've said this, I've believed it, and I've heard it. I turned my will and life over to God in step three, and I'm still eating, and my daughter is still this, and my son is still that, and my... Nope. You don't turn anything over to God in step three. You make a decision to turn your life and your will over to God in step three. What is my life and what is my will? What am I turning over? My food? Part of it. What is my will in my life? My will is my thinking. My life is my action. I'm turning my action and my thought to God. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Sorry about that. Okay. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. So we try different things to get our way. We want what we want. We want our will. We want what we want, or we want everybody dead. To one degree or another, give me what I want. Now, like you, I have people in my life that if they would only do what I say, how I want them to do it, I know they'd be better off. I've got a 15-year-old at home, and I've got a wife, and I'm absolutely sure that they would be better off, as would I, if they would only listen to me and do what I want them to do. But they have a will and a life and a God of their own. And very oftentimes, it's in conflict with what I want. I invite anyone to go to my 15-year-old and try to tell her to do what you want her to do. You're more than welcome to go ahead and try it. But the bottom line is, I have to understand that this is what's going on here. I just want them to do what I want, and I'm playing God. So let's see where the instructions take me from there. Okay? What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself even more. Nagging, begging, screaming, silent treatment. Okay. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. Now, there's four things all active addicts do. All active addicts do four things. They do them all the time. They lie. They assign blame. They keep score in their relationships and fight battles that just don't exist. And you can see some of these behaviors: lying, assigning blame, keeping score, fighting battles that don't exist. As we move through the steps, you will see how all of that will get covered. Okay? He becomes angry, indignant, and self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants, and do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And as I look at my life, the more I pushed people, the more they pushed back. The more I pulled people, the more they pulled back. They see through my BS. They see, in many cases or all cases, that I'm trying to manipulate them. They see what I want very clearly, even though because I don't want them to see it, I think they can't. Just because I don't want you to see something doesn't mean it isn't the elephant in the room. That's me lying to me. They see it. They see it. We see it in them and think they can't see it in us. Okay. Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave, the outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pity? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. We wanted what we wanted, and we pushed them, and we pulled them, and we lied to them, and we manipulated them, and we tried to get them to do what we wanted them to do, and they saw through it and often wouldn't do it. And when those resentments came to pass, I couldn't believe that they had been that mad at me. What were they so angry about? Because the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I measured my intentions and they were looking at my actions. I had good intentions, good meaning, self-seeking and selfish. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. Though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must or it kills us. God makes that possible, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. Not my suggester, not anything but my director. I must place myself in a situation where God is going to direct me. And how God directs me is through the steps and through what seems effortless and easy. When I'm doing God's will, and we'll talk about that in the later steps tomorrow morning, it's really flowing downstream. When I want my will, I find myself power driving against the stream, and it's exhausting. It's absolutely exhausting when those situations arise in my life. God's will is what feels the best. It just feels right to do that thing. And then when I'm trying to convince myself, anytime I'm trying to convince myself that some other course of action is better, I'm in trouble. Because when that committee is meeting, it's usually chaired by my ego. Okay, where am I, George? Okay, thank you. He is the principal, we are his agents, he is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. What a line. There's promises there that I want to come true in my life, and I've seen them come true by doing the work. We were reborn. I am not the person that I was when I came in here. I have not just been altered physically. I have been inwardly rearranged, as it says. Who has the program that they're working? It's real evident. The people that are looking at you, and they're you can just see it. You can just feel it. It's like a tangible thing. And this is a beautiful, beautiful paragraph of promises and heartfelt emotion for me that I can actually begin to lose my fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. I never knew anything but fear. I never knew anything but to judge your outsides with my insides, and how was I going to stack up to that? I never knew anything else existed. And it seemed that everybody was smarter than me and better than me and certainly stronger than me because they were coping and I couldn't. I didn't know how. I didn't know. We were now at step 3. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him. Now, before we say this, if you've really conceived of the ABCs and you see yourself as a compulsive overeater who cannot manage his own life, and you really do believe that God could and would if he were sought, would you utter this prayer with me so I don't have to do it by myself? God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. You have now taken the first 3 steps here in this Big Book Boot Camp. Step 3 is misunderstood. I've said that before. Step 3 is useless for me unless it's immediately followed by four. Because the big book just got through telling me that if I'm going to really take step three, then I need to turn my will over to, and my life over to God. And how do I do that? Well, it's in step four. Let's see where we go. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning. The first three steps is only a beginning. And in several times in the book, we're going to see where he refers back to step three as a beginning. So if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Next, it doesn't say in a year. It doesn't say in 3 years. It says next. Now, the big book is very clear that next means next. And so if we've taken the first three steps, next we launched on a course of vigorous action. We're done thinking now. Action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, many of which had never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, and we talked about that before, that food is a symptom. So we had to get down to causes and conditions. And again, there are people, and me too. I have to remember that if I've done the first three steps, I'm walking around with a notebook and a pencil in my hand doing my inventory. I have to remember that the first two steps, conclusions of the mind, third step is the formal terms of surrender. It's a beginning, it's a decision. To do what? To do 4 through 12. To do 4 through 12. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step 4. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Now, every single day of my life, without exception, I thought about some things. I thought about what you did to me yesterday. I thought about what you didn't do for me the day before yesterday. I thought about what that teacher said to me in 1963. I thought about what that SOB boss did to me in 1989. And on and on and on. The word resentment comes from two ancient words, re, which always means to do again, repaint, review, resod, replant, means to do again. And the other word, sentiment, comes from an old word, sentiri, which means to feel. It means to re-feel. Now, I am a sports fan, and I love the Chicago Bears. They are my favorite team. I love the Bears. Too bad they suck this year. I love the Bears, and I have videos at home of the Super Bowl that they won against the New England Patriots. I can tell you what the announcer's going to say. I can tell you what commercial comes after what commercial. And I can tell you exactly what that film is indelibly etched in my mind. And it never changes. Never changes. Every single time I put in that video, it's exactly the way it was the last 100 times I watched it. Now, there's something that is a little bit different about me, and that every day I turned on, in the beginning of my day, my resentment replay video cassette machine. Only there was a huge difference. Every single time I thought about what you did to me yesterday, and every single time I thought about what you didn't do for me the day before, and every single time I think about what that teacher didn't do for me in 1963 or what that SOB boss said to me in 1989, I change it just a little bit. I make what you did more horrible, and I make my actions more innocent. So that if you give me enough time, I was standing there, pure as the driven snow, innocent me, and you came along and you did me dirt, you son of a... And I believe that. Remember, all addicts lie. Well, it's not just to others, it's to themselves too. I turn on my resentment machine and I would replay those resentments over and over and over again in my mind. And then I would have conversations with people. Sometimes they were dead. Sometimes I hadn't seen them for 30 years. More often than not, I would have conversations with people and say this. The next time he does that to me, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say that, and I'm going to do this, and I should have said this, and I should have done that. And I'm having all these gesticulations and conversations with people who are not in the room. Sounds crazy, right? Okay. Where do these resentments come from? Where do these fears come from? Where do these things come from? They come from a specific place. They don't just flitter in through the air. Every human being is born with three basic instincts of life. They are the social instinct. Everybody wants to be accepted by the group, and everybody wants to be a part of the group, or the leader of the group, or the treasurer of the group, or whatever. And the social instinct is a very important instinct, because God never gives us anything that's bad. And the social instinct was embedded in us by God and is good. It showed early human beings that by dividing the labor and working together, they could accomplish more than they could as individuals. When Fred's barn burned down, all of the farmers went over and helped Fred build his new barn and paint his new barn. And when Sam got sick, all of the farmers went over there and tended his crops and took care of things as best they could. Human beings have an instinct for social togetherness and social cooperation that is very important, and it is embedded in our psyches by God, and it is a good thing when used properly. When I am trying to power drive my way through the social instinct, it can become bad. Maybe I want to be the leader of the group. But you've already elected someone else or chosen someone else. So what do? I do a little lying, a little manipulating, a little something, scheming, whatever it is, to try to besmirch the reputation of that other person so that they won't be the leader of the group anymore and I can take their place. And when they get wind of that, they don't like that very much. So they start fighting back. They start pushing back. They start stepping on my toes. And when they do, they cause pain and resentment and fear in me. All of this is self-centered fear. I want what I want. I want to be the leader of the group. I want to be a member of the group, what have you. I want what I want. And what I have to remember is other people want those things too. And so I have to work in cooperation. Part of the social instinct is what I think of myself. And what I think of myself is usually not what I really think of myself, but I will think of myself as it reflects back from you. In other words, I don't think about myself in any other way usually than this. If you think I'm a nice guy, I will generally think I'm a nice guy too. And if you think I'm a schmo, then I will generally think I'm a schmo too. And so part of the social instinct is, what do I think of me? The social instinct is very important. I want to look good in front of people that are important to me. And I think we can all understand that.